Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Here is a genius summer cooking tip that I came up with this year. Microwave your broccoli. I mean, what I mean is, 9 times out of 10, I cook my broccoli by roasting it in a really hot oven because, you know, everyone loves the crispy, frizzled edges at the end of the florets. But right now, I truly cannot care enough about frizzled broccoli ends to have a box blasting 425 degrees into my home, so I started microwaving it. 3 minutes at a time till it's cooked, and then olive oil and salt and pepper, and then I threw it under the broiler for a couple minutes just to char the tops. It is not the same at all, but it's good enough, and I don't have to pass out from heat stroke. So hey, that's a win. Our guests this week, though, they have more admirable ideas on summer cooking than, man, just microwave it. My personal hero, Helen Rosner of The New Yorker, comes through to help answer your summer cooking questions. And the amazing Philadelphia chef Shola Olunloyo drops a brilliant 10-minute recipe for creamed corn pudding on us. But first, I want to turn to the summer kitchen, the literal summer kitchen that Olia Hercules grew up with. Olia is a British food writer who writes often about the food of her original homeland, Ukraine. And in her telling, the food of Ukraine is bright and vibrant and re-energized after 30 years of rediscovering itself after the Soviet era. And when she thinks back to her childhood and food, one place that stands out to her, and millions of Ukrainians around the world apparently, is the summer kitchen. A freestanding kitchen families would traditionally build in their gardens. Her new book, Summer Kitchens, is an ode to those places and the food made in them. So hi, Olia.
Hi, Francis. Thank you for having me today.
I'm so excited to have you. Hey, can I actually start by telling you my version of a summer kitchen?
Yes, please.
So it is 95 degrees out today, and my downstairs neighbor is out of town and left me her keys. So tonight for dinner, I am totally going to go down to her place and like sear my chicken thighs so I don't have to open the windows in my own apartment. Like, I'm totally going to break into her apartment and cook. But when you, that's like all I can think of when I think of summer kitchens now. But when you were growing up in Ukraine, summer kitchens were a more legit affair, maybe we'll call them. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah. So summer kitchens exist all over Ukraine, especially kind of rural areas and smaller towns. And they are a one-room building, basically. Nothing glamorous. And they're situated just a few steps away from your main porch, from your main house. And you know, it looks almost like a smaller version of your house. It's got 4 walls, a roof, a porch, and inside you've got your stove and sometimes a big kind of like masonry oven. If you had a specialist in the village, they would install one of those where you cook and it also heats the building. And they are used during the summer to cook your everyday meals. And also their main purpose actually is to do all of your preserving for winter, because Ukraine is, people live very seasonally, and quite a few people still have, I call them vegetable patches, but actually they're more like small holdings. So you'd get this great big glut of vegetables and fruit come September, and people would bring all of their 3-liter jars out and would start preserving. And, you know, it's almost like a semi-industrial operation. So it would be really quite messy and quite hot to do it in your main house. So these kitchens are almost like kitchen workshops of sorts where people do all of these kind of things. Yeah.
And what do you remember most about yours from when you were young?
So our summer kitchen was made out of brick, just our like our main house. You know, if, for example, in northern Ukraine, you get them made out of wood and they're very pretty. So ours was, you know, not as charming as some of them can be. But, you know, of course, as a child, I have the most wonderful memories connected to it. So I would run in the summer, would wake up, and I would kind of, you know, trundle to the summer kitchen, and my mom would be gone, you know, she'd be at work, and she would always leave things on the table there. So she would pick some strawberries and leave them in this beautiful enamel bowl, and she'd make these lazy dumplings, as we call them, made with curd cheese.
Wait, what's a lazy dumpling?
Lazy dumplings, they're almost like Italian nudie. So you'd use this curd cheese, which I guess an American equivalent will be quark. And you mix it with just a little bit of flour. You know, it's mainly cheese, a little bit of flour and an egg for binding, a little bit of salt. And then you just make these little pillows almost, and you boil them. And then actually we had them sweet. I think my mom tossed them in butter and added a little bit of sugar there as well. But now I make it with honey.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, and she would also do all of this kind of crazy preserving come September with all the jars and everything. And she'd pick all of the berries that we grow, and should have this really massive pot of jam on the stove, and the best bit of it was the foam that would collect on top. And in Britain, some people say, "Oh, it's scum," but to us, it was like the tastiest bit. It was like basically aerated sugar and fruit juices. So she'd collect it, put it into a bowl, and that was a special treat.
Oh, cool! Well, yeah, this is so interesting because I feel like, you know, every traditional culture has this notion of like, oh, now it's time for harvest. Obviously, in the warmer months, we have to preserve for the colder times of the year. But why was there this particular unique tradition of having its own structure, having its own space? You write this really beautiful line in the book, "The summer kitchens encourage a very intimate, almost spiritual connection to every living thing around you." Why do you think that was so important in the culture that you grew up in?
Well, actually, you know, a young couple's life would often start in a summer kitchen. So they existed in one form or another in the early 20th century. But after the Second World War, a young couple would get married, and then they would get, you know, a piece of land, perhaps, even though it was the Soviet Union, you know, in the south of Ukraine. In Ukraine, it was still possible. And they would quickly build this little structure, a one-room structure, and they would put a makeshift bed in it and a stove, and then they would build the bigger house during the warmer months. You know, maybe the villagers will come and help out. And then they would also put their seeds in for the, you know, grow their vegetables, put their small orchard trees in. So all of this, their life would basically kind of like mushroom around them. And then eventually they would move into the bigger house, but they would have this separate structure, which of course, you know, then would be handy to use as a kitchen in the summer. And now it's, you know, we've seen so many of them. We've traveled all over Ukraine, and you know, we did about 10,000 kilometers or so. Ukraine is huge. And they're so different. Sometimes they're just one room, but some people have really gone all out, and that, you know, they even like add on different rooms and build them up a little bit. So you've got your main house, and then you've got this summer kitchen with kind of like extra bits. Sometimes they turn them into granny flats and put like even a bath in and stuff. So, you know, they're developing more and more, and they're also disappearing, sadly. Some younger generations, you know, people of my age and younger don't really want them anymore. Perhaps they, you know, preserving is still done by older generations, but maybe the younger ones are not as interested anymore.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you had an interesting note, which was that in the Soviet era, you know, the Soviet government tried to standardize the cuisine across the USSR, and, you know, a huge, like, the biggest landmass in, like, history, right?
Yeah.
So, like, so you're trying to standardize all these cultures that existed over many thousands of miles, and you wrote that Ukrainian traditions and language, and in some cases, maybe even the fruits and vegetables started to disappear during that process of Soviet standardization.
Yeah.
And although you're saying now some of this summer kitchen culture might be leaving, you also write that some of these things are also making a resurgence sort of at the same time. Tell us about that resurgence.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, you read some of the older Ukrainian books. I've got one, for example, from 1913 is one of the oldest ones. And, you know, vegetables like asparagus during Soviet years, all of that has been discouraged and underdeveloped. And, you know, people stopped using vegetables like rhubarb, for example. People used to use it a lot in Ukraine, but I only encountered it for the first time when I came to Britain. But people are trying to resurrect some of the old traditions, practices, and also trying to grow all of this produce that that has been kind of forgotten for the past kind of 70, 80 years. Apparently, there are, you know, a lot of organic farms appearing, and also loads of restaurants in the bigger cities where they really take interest in Ukrainian cuisine, because, you know, even after the Soviet Union has fallen apart in the 90s, we suddenly went, oh, freedom, you know, we can go abroad now and we can discover all of these foods. And that's what people were really concentrated on. You know, all of a sudden, everybody wanted to use olive oil, even though it was quite bad quality olive oil, you know, or everybody wanted to eat sushi and everybody wanted to eat, you know, Italian ravioli. And we have forgotten about all of this amazing stuff that we already had and that we had, you know, in the past as well. But luckily, in the last 10 years, I think people went, oh, wait a minute, but we've got this incredible unrefined sunflower oil, for example, which, you know, it's really nutty and rich in flavor, almost like sesame oil in a way. You know, it tastes like toasted sunflower seeds. Oh, cool. So people are coming back to those things. And of course, there's the borscht as well, which in central Ukraine and Poltava is cooked with these dried smoked pears. Can you imagine the flavor of that?
Oh, cool.
Oh, it's so good. And but people are kind of, you know, remembering, and restaurateurs are a bit more interested. And a few food writers in Ukraine as well are starting to discover that, hey, we've got so much that that we can bring back. So, yeah, there is a resurgence.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Yeah, I love it. You know, there's the chef Rene Redzepi of Noma in Copenhagen always talks about the idea of people finding their cooking voice. And a lot of times he talks about it in terms of people finding the cooking voice that was already there. And that's totally what that sounds like to me.
Exactly. That's such a beautiful way to put it. Yeah.
There's just also this really, this is a little bit like the cookbook nerd in me because I see so many cookbooks, but there's a really unique feature at the end of your book. You've published letters from strangers, I believe,
yeah.
Who wrote to you about their summer kitchens that they remember. Tell us about those letters.
When I was doing research, I've sent an appeal out, and you know, they completely struck me. It was a lot of Ukrainians that perhaps left Ukraine, and you know, a few of them came from the US and Britain also. A few of them have had those summer kitchens in eastern Ukraine, for example, where, you know, the conflict is still going on, and perhaps those places are completely lost. So there's, you know, there's just, they read so beautifully and so lyrically. And of course, you know, it's descriptions of their childhoods mainly. There's one person that says, a woman that says that, you know, when we were kids, we used to live in the city and we used to be quite like skinny city kids. And then after we've been for 3 months, you know, with our grandmother and have eaten all of this fresh produce, all of the, you know, massive tomatoes that she's grown, or strawberries, and, you know, all of these treats and stuff that come back looking incredibly healthy. there's another memory of how, I don't know if that essay actually made into the book, but there's another one where she says, our summer kitchen was used for cooking, for doing something with the tractor's engine, you know, for keeping, there's a special place where the chickens lived as well. And it just paints a really gorgeous picture of Ukrainian life, and also kind of like children's lives, because I think for most of us, and I sometimes say I do over romanticize, you know, summer kitchens a little bit, because me they're the stuff of childhood, but I'm definitely not the only one.
Yeah, you know, maybe you are romanticizing them a little bit, but yeah, this is what we do. It's what we do to stay grounded, right? So thank you so much.
Thank you, Francis.
Olya Hercules' latest book is Summer Kitchens, Recipes and Remembrances from Every Corner of Ukraine. And she left us with a recipe for those lazy dumplings with green beans, poppy seeds, and crispy shallots. It's at splendidtable.org. Coming up, we have a fantastic idea for sweet corn from the chef Shola Olunloyo. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. I guess you could call Shola Olunloyo the ultimate home cook. And by that, I mean he creates food at the highest levels of innovation, dishes that, honestly, in a lot of cases, you would never even find in a restaurant because they're so technical and refined. But he does it in his home in Philadelphia. He calls his workshop Studio Kitchen, and there he does ticketed dinners, now all to take away, and he researches new techniques using cutting-edge equipment that cookware makers want him to experiment with. You can follow his mind-blowing adventures on Instagram, at StudioKitchen1, where lately he's been doing stuff like dry-aging whole salmon for 50 days. For mere mortal home kitchens, though, Shola also has a fantastic, super simple, super delicious idea for good sweet corn. Hey, Shola.
Hi, Francis. Nice to see you again.
The same, the same. So, for our listeners who may not know you, your food is amazing. You are a chef. You work out of a studio, and really, much more than a restaurant chef, you're so dedicated to innovation and seeing what technology can do and how you can sort of push technology. And so, I've long thought of you as someone who really pushes the boundaries, not of just what we do with food, but of what we understand about food. But you also apparently have this amazing summer sweet corn dish that is super simple. Can you just tell us about it?
Yeah, so the sort of inspiration of this dish was the kind of the steakhouse classic of creamed spinach, which is really rich, spinachy. I'm not necessarily sure that a very rich, delicious steak needs something equally rich, but creamed spinach is loved by many, and it's a very interesting dish because if you look at other cultures like India, it's kind of like similar to like saag paneer, which is also delicious, you know. So I thought I'd build a dish with corn around something like that, you know, because it's the height of corn season. Corn is sweet and delicious right now. And it's a creamed corn dish, but I tried to sort of make sure that the corn flavor is the sort of really strong operative flavor, because cream also is a diluting agent as far as flavor. Like when you add cream to a dish, it becomes creamier, but it also tastes less like what you started with, you see. So I kind of formulated this dish taking some of the science of the ingredient, which is corn is really the source of cornstarch. So it should thicken somewhat naturally. And then you add some cream for richness. And then to sort of borrow from like bread puddings, savory bread puddings, which are delicious, to tighten up the mixture with like just the inside of the crumb of brioche, which again is basically butter stabilized with flour, you know. So you get a dish that's like really soulful, delicious, great texture, tastes like corn. It's like just like a crowd pleaser.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really require any kind of high-tech devices. It's just basically simple, disciplined cooking.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic.
So yeah, talk us through the process. Like talk us through the recipe.
So the process is like when you cream dishes, obviously, you kind of want to avoid too much caramelization. You're not looking for like a roasted, toasted dish. So the ingredients are basically corn, garlic, ginger, a sweet onion preferably, but a Spanish onion would be fine,
mm-hmm.
Cream, salt, and basically nutmeg or mace. I tend to prefer mace in subtle dishes like this.
Okay.
But nutmeg is fine. So the first thing you do ahead is just kind of dice the onion into like a, you know, relatively fine dice. Okay. And you cook the onions in a little bit of butter just till they're translucent. You're not trying to give them any color, no browning. It's not caramelized onion, just sweet onions cooked in butter. And okay. then you take that off the heat, drain them if it needs to be drained, but set them aside. And the composition of the dish is basically melting a little bit more butter, cooking some corn that's been shaved off the cob. It's very important that you use fresh corn for this dish because the starch is still active and the flavor is still sweet. Mm, like I would okay. not go buy like a bag of corn from like the supermarket in the freezer section. It's a waste of time.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. And then you cook the corn in a little bit of butter. You add some finely diced garlic and ginger.
Okay.
And just cook those till they're fragrant. You're not looking for any color, just a gentle cook, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
One side note, ginger, anything you cook with corn, you should add ginger to. You know?
Why?
Just trust me, do that. It's just a science affinity thing. Corn, ginger, gold, you know.
Really?
So, yeah. Okay. You could actually literally just melt ginger and butter, just a little bit, and then cook corn on the cob and pour that on top of it. And you will be very happy. Yeah.
Okay, I'm so excited just to try it.
Try it. Yeah, okay. It's magic.
Ginger plus corn.
So back to our recipe. You know, you're cooking the corn in a little bit of butter. You add garlic and ginger, get it all fragrant. And then you add your previously cooked onions.
Sure.
The reason I do it in a two-step process is I don't want the cooking of the corn to be dependent on the cooking of the onions. So you can just cook the onions ahead. And once the onions are added, you can just continue to proceed, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you add some cream, just enough like to cover the mixture by maybe about a centimeter or two.
Okay.
And the dish at that point is essentially done when the starch is cooked. You'll notice it'll thicken a little bit because you activate the starch in the corn with the heat.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still relatively liquid. And what would typically happen in these kinds of dishes, a la cream spinach, is you would then boil it till like the cream reduces. It gets a little gloopy, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it's more of a cooked flavor, yeah.
Exactly. So we want like the freshness of corn, like in a farm, eaten off the cob. So at that point, the trick is like we need to either thicken the cream or reduce it. And so if you go back to my whole concept of bread pudding, you just basically buy a loaf of really good brioche. You cut off all sides, you know, no brown, just okay. the middle inside. It's kind of a sad sacrifice of bread, but you can make breadcrumbs with the best.
You can snack on the crust. It's fine.
You know? Exactly, yeah. And then you just buzz it in a food processor till it's like a crumbly powder. And you just add that to your, just enough of that to your corn mixture till it absorbs the cream and tightens up.
Yes.
And so now you have a corn pudding.
Yes.
And at that point, it's done. That's it. Like grate on like a couple of rasps of nutmeg or put like a pinch of mace in it. And you're finished. Like salt, obviously, when you're cooking the corn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's really like a 3 to 5 minute dish, you know. But it borrows inspiration from several preparations, which is like, first of all, cream spinach, cornbread. And then the whole idea of using bread as a texture adjuster is something that we do with, what's the answer? Meatballs. Ding, ding, ding. You know?
Yeah.
Every time you make really good meatballs.
Yeah, totally.
You always add some bread soaked in milk. You know, the classic French term is panade.
Mm-hmm.
And then it makes the meatballs more tender.
Right.
You know? But it also absorbs some of the, you know, the fat and the milk. And it's an emulsifier. So you get this lovely corn pudding. And you can just really honestly eat it as is, you know. It's just really a tremendous dish.
There
are derivative applications of this dish, which I added to the recipe for the ambitious.
Okay.
Which is like, you can make it, cool it down, and then add a little bit of olive oil and Parmesan cheese, whip it nicely, and then use it as a stuffing for ravioli or agnolotti or like that. You know, it's fantastic. You don't even need anything except brown butter and like Parmesan.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, that sounds so good.
And then, of course, there is the low-hanging fruit, which is just put it back into like an oven-proof dish and cover it with like a scant amount of Gruyere and just bake it like a gratin. You know, done.
Okay,
you know,
this is getting outlandish. Yeah. I am excited to try this. Thank you so much, Shola.
You're welcome.
Shola Olunloyo is the brain behind Studio Kitchen in Philadelphia. You can find him on Instagram at Studio Kitchen 1. You can find his recipe for brioche cream corn at splendidtable.org. Helen Rosner has the range. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker, arguably the greatest magazine in American letters, and arguably her most popular story for The New Yorker involves making roast chicken with the help of a hairdryer. She's the author of the greatest essay ever written about the Olive Garden, truly one of the greatest essays I've ever read, period. And she recently wrote about the philosophical ramifications of air conditioning and the art of the no-cook summer dinner, which, far from chefy pretension, can mean a box of popsicles and some gin. And that was all the excuse we needed to ask her in to help me answer your summer cooking questions. Hey, Hells. How's summer been?
Hey, France. It's been pretty hot.
Yeah, I never actually call you Hells, except that, like, you know, your Twitter handle is Hells, and now I feel like in real life I should start calling you Hells, even though I've been staring at your Twitter handle for 9 years.
You can do that. I mean, people do call me Hells. I respond to it. It's, you know, it's weird. Helen is not really a name that lends itself to nicknames, you know. Does anyone ever call you Frank?
Only people who, like, they're trying to emasculate me when they call me Frank, because, like, Frank is such a much more masculine name than Francis.
I feel like you could totally... You would crush it as a Frank. I don't know. I feel like if you call me Hells, I get to call you Frank, and both of those are understood to be coming from a place of love.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. All 5'6" of me appreciates that. You can't have a self-respecting Frank under 5'9". That's my theory on that.
No, man, masculinity has no measure. You can be a strong, capable man at any height.
Well, thank you for saying that. I've struggled with that my whole life. I want to talk about summer with you. And I've read your column, and I want to talk to you about air conditioning, because I have such a complicated feeling about air conditioning, because I feel like I want it, and yet I also hate it, and I hate that I want it.
I think that that's probably the right way to feel about it. You know, I mean, I think, like, if we don't allow ourselves to have moral thinking about air conditioning, it's wonderful, especially during a summer like this one that is sort of more, at least here in New York, like more relentlessly hot than I'm used to New York summers being, for I think reasons of both climate and emotion. Like, air conditioning is this ability to opt out of summer, which is when you need it, you need it desperately, you know. But it's not like so many things in this modern life, it is not an unalloyed good, you know. Like, it turns out air conditioning is best used in moderation for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of deadens you to the season. You don't really feel like it's summer if you don't have to feel that it's summer. And, you know, obviously you're a cooking and food writer, and so the thrust of your article was how it changes the way you cook, and it sort of makes you feel like the only thing keeping you from a pot roast in the middle of July is a sense of decency.
Right.
So, you know, we've been taking questions from our listeners, cooking questions from our listeners, and, you know, I've always wanted to have you on the show, and I felt like this was a great time to have you on the show, because we got a question from Janisa in Queens.
Hey, my name is Janisa, calling from New York. Okay, so it's freaking hot outside, and my hair is turning into a big, puffy afro, so I just cannot bear to turn on the oven. What are some of your favorite minimal cooking recipes that are fast to make? Thanks.
Oh my gosh. I mean, Janisa has touched on, like, the fundamental question of all warm weather, right? Which is, how do I feed myself and my loved ones when I have absolutely no desire to move my body at all, let alone move my body in front of, like, a heat generating device?
Yeah.
Let me just light a large fire that gets up to 475 degrees here in the middle of my home. But yeah, no, I mean, it's exactly the question. And the column that I wrote and what you were talking about was how much I love the nothingness of summer dinners, like the when you're so overwhelmed by heat and tiredness. And I have sort of the luxury of not having to feed little people in my house, so I can just sort of say to my husband, like, we're having popsicles for dinner, and I don't have to feel like I've failed as a parent. I've just sort of become a weird cool wife. But then on the other hand, which I think is what Janisa is asking about, there's this question of like, I actually do have to eat a meal, or maybe I don't have to, sure. but I am responsible for other people's meals. And so maybe I have to put a little bit of thought into this and make sure there's some nutritional value to this. I wonder, this just occurred to me, so I have no, like, you know, authoritative explanation of why this might be the case. But I wonder if it just comes down to the fact that it really is just about making things look pretty on a plate and being like, all right, here's your meal. And the only tool that we've used is a knife.
There's actually some connection between, like, the absolute primal simplicity of we could have been cave people and done this, you know, because all we had was, like, a sharp implement. And yet, like, you filter it through, like, the aesthetic sense of, oh, let me at least, like, put it really in a beautiful, nice mound. Or maybe, like, you put it in a bowl and then you, like, put beautiful things around the bowl. And suddenly it feels like, oh, this is actually like the demonstration of civilization, right? Like, we are in fact primal animals.
Yes, our aesthetic sense is what truly makes us human. Yeah.
Boom, here we are.
Yeah. I mean, I think like the Caprese salad, which in many ways is like the no-cook dinner, is also for a lot of home cooks one of the sort of easiest ways to flirt with the idea of making the plate look pretty. I mean, I know when I was mm-hmm. becoming confident as a cook, and I would bake Caprese salads, which is just, you know, this simple trio of tomato and mozzarella and basil. It's so simple to just layer them in a pretty way on the plate. And all of a sudden you're plating, right? Like, you're doing that scary thing that restaurants do. And it's like, oh, I can do this. And that simple act of putting a little bit of aesthetic intentionality into it makes something feel a little bit more like a meal and a little bit less like a struggle meal.
I think you're right. I think, oh, when you're playing with these like simple elements, you can actually do something like quite lovely with them when you just kind of keep it simple. And blending cold soups is really, truly a joy and a pleasure for me. And I was reminded of this recently because I bought a whole bunch of cucumbers and they were in the fridge. They were too far back in the fridge. They froze. And I was so heartbroken because now once a cucumber freezes and thaws, it's like a snake. You know, it's like, it becomes like very wiggly. And I thought, I have to throw this thing out. I can't throw anything out. And so I threw those thawed cucumbers into a blender and just whirred them up with a single clove. It was like two cucumbers, a single clove of garlic, raw garlic. So it was like really nice and hot. Like, it was plenty for the whole thing. And then I just threw in a bunch of yogurt. And that, like,
You made tzatziki.
Well, it was enough yogurt, so it was still like soupy.
Yeah, no. I'm really pleased to hear that you are a cold soup fan, because I'm also a huge cold soup fan. And I think that cold soups, especially in this era of the widespread smoothie, get a lot of pushback from people who are just like, it's just a smoothie. And I guess it is, right?
It was like a cold soup before it was a smoothie.
Yeah, I mean, if we want to get into these sort of like taxonomic questions, like, where is the line between a smoothie and a cold soup? And I don't think there is one. Like, I think, like, I have a very generous and inclusive definition of this sort of thing. But I think that cold soup for dinner sounds more substantial than smoothie for dinner. So I'm willing to call it a cold soup. One of my super favorite meals is like a gazpacho. And like, again, I sort of very generously define gazpacho with some cold poached shrimp, maybe dangled over the side of the glass as if it's a shrimp cocktail, or just sort of on the side. But I feel like cold shrimp and cold soup is just, it's heaven. It's one of the most fabulous, stupidly low effort to high elegance payoff kind of meals that you can possibly have.
That's Helen Rosner, staff writer for The New Yorker, helping me answer your hot weather cooking questions. We'll both be back in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table. We're back here with the New Yorker staff writer Helen Rosner, and we are taking your hot weather cooking questions. We love getting your voice memo, so keep sending them in, please. And we've got some great shows coming up, including one on things you've got to try. What do you think people need to try? Be it a recipe, an ingredient, a technique they would never think to do? Let us know. The more surprising, the better. Record your ideas or questions you want us to answer as a voice memo on your phone and email them, contact@splendidtable.org. Now let's get back to Helen and your questions. Let's move on to a question from Michelle.
Hi, my name is Michelle, and I live in Ithaca, New York. And I have a question about Swiss chard. We belong to a local, wonderful CSA. We're getting a lot of Swiss chard this summer, and I think it's a beautiful plant, but it also takes up a lot of room in the refrigerator. And of course, fridge space is at a premium during this time of rarely going grocery shopping. So I've been trying to come up with a number of easy recipes. I tried cooking it down quickly in a pan and adding some walnuts and goat cheese and vinegar.
That sounds great.
I was told that was a little too chewy. So then I tried more of a Japanese style where I blanched it and marinated it in mirin and soy sauce and dashi. And I was told that might be a bit too soggy. And so I guess I'm just looking for some new inspiration. My husband does like to chop it up and put it in boxed mac and cheese, which is pretty good, except I can't have a lot of cow dairy. So I guess what I'm looking for is a vegetarian or maybe a little bit of fish recipe to sort of inspire my family to love Swiss chard. Thanks so much. We love your show.
Oh, Michelle. Well, thank you, Michelle. I first want to say to Michelle, thank you for your question. I second want to say to her, I don't know. It sounds like you're doing really great with the Swiss chard, and maybe what you should do is tell people who don't like it they can go make their own damn Swiss chard. Those are like great ideas.
They're so good. I'm obsessed with this question because I'm obsessed with Swiss chard. It's been my sort of surprising MVP of my summer vegetable drawer so far. Yeah, so a couple of weeks ago, I threw dramatic circumstances beyond my control, I came into possession of a bunch of rainbow chard that was like the size of a human child. Michelle is not exaggerating about how huge chard is. If you think about like how much space, you know, a bunch of kale takes up in your refrigerator. Chard is like kale times 400. And so I had this massive thing of rainbow chard, and I was, you know, confronted with what to do with it. And it turns out chard is amazing, and now it's all I want to eat and buy. And there's a recipe that I've been making over and over and over for the last couple of weeks that I think hits every single point that Michelle is looking for. So what I've been doing is I've been making a kind of Thai-inspired seafood curry. There's no dairy. It's coconut milk. And basically you stir-fry some aromatics, some garlic and onion and ginger, and I slice up a jalapeno because I like things to be really spicy, and you add some coconut milk and a little bit of fish sauce, and then I poach fish in that, and then I add at the end some very finely chopped Swiss chard leaves, and I have a gorgeous curry that you can eat over rice or you can eat on its own. But you can also make it without the fish. I made it one day for some vegetarian friends and just left the fish out, and we just had Swiss chard simmered in coconut milk, and it was heaven. I mean, it's so delicious. And then the other magical thing about Swiss chard is that the stems are also really great. And what I tend to do when I bring chard or kale or any of those huge leafy greens home from the grocery store is I try to prep them right away. So with chard, I'll separate the leaves from the stems, and I'll usually chop up the leaves roughly, and I'll shove them in a big plastic bag. And then you get to do this really, really fun thing of compressing all of the air out of them in the bag. And it's just, oh, it feels so good to just squish it down and see how tight you can get your bundle of chard leaves. And then that takes up almost no
space. I mean, whatever floats your boat.
It's like a visceral physical pleasure. I really recommend that you do it. And then you have these beautiful stems, which a lot of people throw away, and you can throw them away. I'm not going to judge someone if they decide that dealing with chard stems is not their deal. But if you chop those up pretty finely, they're a perfect sort of textural addition to other soups and stews as well. And they end up having a little kind of subtle earthy flavor. And after you simmer them for a while or blanch them or whatever method you're using, they have kind of a texture that's similar to celery. It's great. And if they're rainbow charred, sometimes their color leaches out and turns your soup bright purple.
And that's exciting.
Yeah, I mean, depending on who you are, it could be awesome or terrible.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Let us move on to Carolyn.
Hi, Francis. This is Carolyn calling from Minneapolis, and you've been taking questions. I love it. I have one, the grilled cheese sandwich. I just cannot master it. I'm wondering what the best way is. What I'm finding is that my cheese just doesn't get melted. The toast gets toasted, but the cheese isn't melted enough. What should I be doing? Should I change the temperature? What kind of cheese should I try? Thanks.
Helen, do you have grilled cheese thoughts? I have a lot of grilled cheese thoughts.
I was going to say, I think you're the grilled cheese king. I always think of you when I think of grilled cheese. Because aren't you the person who, I think you're the person who introduced me and possibly many hundreds or thousands of other people to the idea of cooking grilled cheese with mayonnaise rather than butter on the outside.
Yeah, that is a thing. I can't take personal credit for it. I learned it from Gabrielle Hamilton, who is a chef and writer. And she taught me that, yeah, instead of buttering the outside of the bread to cook the grilled cheese, you use mayonnaise. And at first I thought, wow, that sounds really awful. And then she's like, no, don't be stupid. Think about it. And I'm like, oh, I get it. Because mayonnaise is really just oil. It's oiled, emulsified with a little bit of egg yolk, some vinegar or lemon juice. And like, that's pretty much all there is. But oil doesn't burn the way that butter burns. So that is a great way of getting like the outside of your bread toasty and crispy in your pan without, you know, having the burnt butter flavor. To Carolyn's question, I would also say, okay, if you're having trouble getting the right balance of color in the outside without burning, but still having like the cheese melted, then there are a couple ways you can go about it. One, I would say, is you could grate your cheese, just because grated cheese is going to melt a little bit easier than if you're using like a thick slab, if you're cutting like a block of cheddar or something. Or just use like thin sliced cheese. The other thing is you can also probably try turning the heat on your stove down a little bit, and you're cooking it more of like a medium, maybe even medium low heat rather than a high heat. So that way you're going to give it nice time. You're going to give it enough time for the sandwich to heat through and the cheese to melt. And if you're using mayonnaise, that again gives you a little bit more leeway in terms of that timing. But can I tell you like the move I've been doing? My grilled cheeses. 2020 is an awful year, just like the absolute worst year. But the one thing that I would say 2020 is great for is like my child has begun to love me this year because of the way I make her grilled cheese.
Oh, that's beautiful. I'm glad she finally loves you.
I'm glad too. We finally made it. But it's, and I don't know if like I thought of it or someone told it to me, but like it's pretty obvious once like you start doing it. You either save a little bit of your cheese, or you can use a totally different cheese. Oh, and to her question, what kind of cheese? I mean, really, whatever cheese you want is fine. The only thing I would... Yeah, I have no problem with any cheese in your grilled cheese. Use whatever cheese that can melt, and you'll be great. But what I would say is save a little bit of that cheese, or just grab a block of Parmesan. And I use a nonstick pan to make my grilled cheese for this reason. Because after your grilled cheese is nearly done, or maybe even all the way done, what you can do is you can take your pan and grate a bunch of the cheese directly into the pan. Parmesan works great for this because it's so dry. It'll cook down, brown, and crisp really fast, but really most any cheese can do this. Maybe not American because it just goos so much, but you basically cook the cheese until you start to see it sizzle. It starts to fry in its own fat, and when it starts to brown, you slap the grilled cheese back onto it in the pan. And what it does is that cheese is now adhered to your sandwich and it has browned. And when you take the sandwich out with that cheese slabs, when you take the sandwich out with that cheese adhered to it, that cheese will cool down into this beautiful, thin, lacy, crisp layer. And so what you now have is like a grilled cheese, like Napoleon of like crispy cheese and then crispy bread and then gooey cheese and then crispy bread. And if you do it on the other side, you have another layer of crispy cheese, and it is phenomenal.
This is blowing my mind. I mean, it's like a dumpling skirt. It's the same basic idea.
It's like a dumpling skirt.
Of like, you know, all the dumplings that are connected together by a lacy little web of delicious savoriness. Or like bar pies, like pizza pies that have the cheese. Or the, oh my God, my brain is just like a million miles an hour. This is the classic patty melt, right? Like at the best places to get patty melts, they understand that you need to have the cheese melt well beyond the radius of the sandwich so you can get that Frico-ish like cheese cracker that's this halo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the cheese goes to the side. And yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Oh, so do you make it just so it's crackly within the confines of the bread itself, or do you make a skirt of cheese?
Yeah, no. So like what I do is I actually just like cook the cheese. I mean, okay. So I guess what I'd say is if cheese starts leaking out of the bread and it starts to cook in the pan, I just let it go because it does the same thing.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. But in this case, I'm like intentionally cooking just cheese and then slapping the bread back onto it, like taking the sandwich and then like slapping the sandwich back onto this cheese that's cooking by itself in the pan. So you like now like just creating
grilled cheese with a cheese
layer
halo.
Of crisp cheese. Yes.
This is brilliant. You're a genius. Did you invent this?
Thank you. I don't think so. I'm almost sure I did it.
I mean, it might be like calculus where like, you know.
Who invented anything really?
You know, like, is it Isaac Newton? Is it Leibniz? Is it you? Like anybody could have.
Yeah.
The ideas are just in the air.
It could have been anyone.
But
yeah, you just breathe them in. Okay. We have time for one more.
This is Andrea from Portland, Oregon. I have some pomegranate molasses in my fridge that I bought for a recipe ages ago, and I'm looking for new ideas for ways that I might be able to incorporate it into some of my everyday cooking. Thank you for any ideas.
Helen, pomegranate molasses.
Pomegranate molasses.
Go.
I mean, it's one of those ultimate pantry items where you know, Middle Eastern cooking has been such an exciting thing for the last few years that, you know, if you're a home cook who takes your trendy cookbook seriously, you probably have pomegranate molasses in your cabinet. I love it. I use it all the time. I think of it a little bit like a balsamic vinegar analog. That's where mm-hmm. pomegranate molasses lives in my brain. So it's not always going to be quite the same. It's more of that kind of antioxidant tangy rather than a vinegar tangy. But it's wonderful mm-hmm. drizzled on top of ice cream, or if you're going to make one of those absolutely no-cook summer caprese salads, pomegranate molasses over the top instead of balsamic vinegar Ooh. Is killer. It's also really good on a watermelon salad if you're doing a caprese but with watermelon and feta instead of tomato and mozzarella. Pomegranate molasses just knocks that into exciting new realms of tasty deliciousness. I don't know, what can't you put it on? The other thing too is it keeps forever, so it's not like you're racing against the clock. Like, you know, you can wait for the perfect use case to come to you.
Yeah. But okay, so it sounds like anything you'd want, something that's a little bit tart, a little bit viscous. It's not very sweet, I find. Like, I always, maybe it's because of the word molasses, I think of it as a sweet thing, but it's really much more like an astringent, acidic thing than it is like a sweet thing. But it has like a beautiful sort of semi-viscous texture. So yeah. So anything, I mean, look, dude, just put it on stuff.
Yeah.
that's my professional advice. Look, dude, just put it on stuff. Like, but no, like something that's sweet, like watermelon, sweet and fresh and refreshing, that can use a little bit of just like cooked, once fresh but now dank flavor.
I don't know if I would go with dank.
Francis, stop talking.
But okay, no, I mean, so word. Pomegranate molasses is, I was going to say it basically is, but like it is. Pomegranate molasses is just concentrated pomegranate juice. So if you think about the flavor of pomegranate juice, just imagine that, but concentrated 5 or 6 times so that the texture is more like maple syrup than it is like a, you know, a juice that you can, you know, just sort of pour and enjoy. Right. Which, by the way, you can also just dilute pomegranate molasses in water and make something akin to pomegranate juice, or you can use it in cocktails and anytime that you want that
seltzer,
that astringent flavor. So I disagree with you actually about it being sweet. I think that it is very astringent, and it has what I just described as that sort of antioxidant flavor, which I think is kind of that astringency. You also get that with like blueberries mm-hmm. and acai and all of those sort of dark fruits. But part of what makes that astringency delicious instead of difficult is the fact that it's actually very deeply sweet, and the sugar balances it out so that it's a round and gentle flavor even while it's kind of punching you in the face, which I think is why it's so beautiful as a balsamic vinegar analog. Because, you know, when you want to have an aged balsamic, like one of the fancy ones that somebody gives you as a gift and you never know how to use, those are at their best when they're measured out in drips and drops, you know, a little bit on some vanilla ice cream, or a little bit on like some apple pie or a fresh fruit tart or something like that, where you want to kind of add some depth and a little bit of weirdness to something that's otherwise a relatively straightforwardly sweet flavor.
Well, that is exactly the kind of culinary analysis we were looking for from you. So thanks so much, Helen.
Thanks.
It was great talking to you. Helen Rosner is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and she is very, very good at Twitter. You can find her there at Hells. Well, that is our show for the week. Keep sending us your cooking questions. Record them as voice memos on your phone. And again, if you have ideas you think we got to try, record those too. Email them to contact@splendidtable.org. Thanks for listening. Take care, wear a mask, and be safe. We'll talk to you next week. You can listen to all of our podcasts. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And sign up for our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen. It delivers a recipe straight to your inbox every Wednesday to make dinner time a little easier. Sign up at splendidtable.org. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.